While this collection process is on, I would like to proceed. I don't want to waste time. Those of you who do have copies of the memorandum, there are at least several hundred of them that have been distributed, so that those of you who don't have, if you could share perhaps with your neighbor, or on Wednesday, of course, you'll all have copies. The memorandum indicates the outline of the course, schedule of assignments. You begin with the introduction to the Dartmouth Bible and an assignment of the book of Genesis and the book of Deuteronomy for this week. And then you've got, if you look down, you'll see that there are four examinations scheduled. The dates are given. The last examination is on the last day of classes in May 4th. There will be no final examination, as that term is understood. These examinations are 50-minute essay type. I will, of course, make up the questions, and our assistants will read the papers, grade them, and return them to you. But there'll be another opportunity before our first examination to discuss the examinations. Unfortunately, there are no discussion sections. It's a problem that I've had to live with from the very beginning of my teaching here at Cornell. And I have found no solution to this problem, because in order to have discussion sections, either in the first semester or in the second semester, you have to have people who will be able to answer the questions that will come up with the qualifications that they would need to handle the types of questions that are likely to be presented. And we do not have assistants who can do that. There's no reflection on our assistants over the years, including the incumbents, but this is a fact, and I cannot possibly break up a class as large as this into manageable sections and meet with each section. So the only way we can live with the problem is just live with it, as we often do with problems to which there are no solutions. I do welcome questions within manageable restrictions of time and relevance, but those of you who've had 408 know that we do get questions. Some students object to our taking as many questions as we do. They feel that the time could be better spent by continuing with the discussion. Others have felt that there ought to be more room for questions and comments. You can't please everybody. I do the best I can, and let it go with that. There's no perfection in this process. I play it by ear. My ear isn't always perhaps as good as it should be, but we do what we can. We will give you a memorandum with the hours, the days and hours when our assistants will be glad to see you. You can always make appointments with them outside of those hours. You can always make an appointment to see me. I spend a lot of time in the building, in my office. Very few students ever take advantage of that opportunity. You get complaints at times from students that they don't have enough close contact with their professors. But from my experience over the years, I would say that that's largely the fault of the students who do not take advantage of the opportunity. I can't go out and pull students into my office. But if you were to take advantage of the opportunities, you would find that we are available and do welcome students. Unfortunately, most of the time when I do see students, it's about their grade. Some complain, some question about the grades that they've received, but not intellectual discussions that take place. I consider that a great loss, a great personal loss, and perhaps to some degree it's a loss for students as well. There are very few rules for the conduct of the class. I would like you to be prompt in coming, but if you can't come on time, if you steal in the back door on the second floor here, you'd be welcome. You can come in when you can and take a seat. I'd rather have you late than not come at all. We don't take the roll, but we do expect you to come. There's a no smoking rule in the school here for the classrooms. I would like you to observe that. It's for the benefit, we always thought, of the smoker. If he had a 50-minute period in which he would not smoke. But now we know from the more recent government reports that it is also a benefit for those who are captives and sitting near the smoker, because the inhalation of the smoke by the non-smoker is also harmful. So for the benefit of all of us, both comfort and health, I would ask you to please not smoke. One other prohibition, and that is against your reading a newspaper in a way which would make it obvious to me that that's what you are doing. I think there are certain civilities that one needs to observe, I in relation to you and you in relation to me, just as there are, as between any two of you or any group of you among yourselves. Now, I always get the question as to why 409 doesn't come before 408, meaning, of course, the content of the course. But whichever way I would do it, I think I would still get a question, why one rather than the other in the fall, and why one rather than the other in the spring. The choice is more or less arbitrary. The courses are really independent of one another, and yet each throws light, I hope, upon the other. Let me try to tell you a little bit about the course for the semester, and that will help you understand the difference between the two. In the fall semester, we were concerned with certain American ideals that are formulated in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. And they are ideals, and there's no reason for not referring to them as such, the ideal of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, equal protection, so on. Now, these are all what are considered American values, American ideals, American principles. That isn't to say that other people don't have them, but we are talking in the fall semester about the American expression, the American understanding of these values and these principles. We were concerned with these values in the fall semester in factual contexts, as these principles were used and interpreted in specific cases arising in the courts, which presented the questions in a setting of specific facts. The ideals, therefore, took on concrete meanings as they were tested in actual living situations. Now, we were not concerned in the first semester, except only marginally, with these values or these principles or ideals abstractly. For example, we considered freedom of speech in a concrete setting of students in the high school coming to school wearing armbands to protest the war in Vietnam against the regulation of the school which prohibited students from wearing armbands. Or we considered the symbolic speech under the First Amendment of people who burned or who invaded a draft office board and stole the records, or who burned their draft cards, or a person who burned the American flag publicly. Are these legitimate expressions that are protected by the First Amendment? So we saw how American ideals were always intertwined with facts. They were inseparable one from the other. It was very difficult to talk about constitutional liberties outside of concrete factual situations. This is the way the American system operates. For better or for worse, that's the way it is. You can have a different system, but that is our system. And I think the course illustrated how that system operated. Now this term, we are continuing our concern with American values, but with some important similarities and some important differences from the way we did it in the first semester. Now, first of all, the Constitution is not the, or constitutional liberties, the Bill of Rights, is not the invention of Jefferson or of Madison or of the founders of the Republic, the framers of the Constitution. They made their contribution, there's no question about that. But the Bill of Rights has a history that antedates the drafting of the Constitution and the adoption of the Bill of Rights. A history in Western civilization. The Bill of Rights and its values are derivative from much more ancient ideals, and ideals which were much more abstract and also much more universal, much broader than the way the ideals are stated in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. For example, the ideal of human dignity is a presupposition of some of the fundamental liberties that are formulated in the Bill of Rights. The ideal of justice. It's not mentioned in the Bill of Rights. There's no word about human dignity in the Bill of Rights. There's no word about justice. There's nothing about love. There's nothing about equality. There is a provision about equal protection of the law, but that's different from equality. It has some relation, some important relation to the concept of equality. It's derivative from the concept of equality. But it isn't all of equality. Equality is a much broader term than equal protection of the law. The ideal of the rule of law is not mentioned in the Constitution. It's not mentioned in the Bill of Rights. The Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause play a role in the spelling out of the meaning of the rule of law, but they don't exhaust the meaning of the rule of law. The rule of law is a much broader concept and is much more ancient than the Constitution, we hope to see in the weeks ahead. Now, on the other hand, religious liberty, the two clauses relating to religion in the First Amendment, free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, other freedoms, were not thought of in ancient times or even in modern times until very recently as being fundamental human liberties. They are of a very recent vintage. Religious liberty particularly is a very recent development. Nonetheless, our constitutional liberties do reflect and did grow out of ancient, more basic, and more general ideals, such as those that I've mentioned, like human dignity, the ideal of human justice, human equality, and so on. Now, this term, we're going to be concerned with these broader conceptions and with their history. How did they come to us? Secondly, in the fall semester, our materials were all American, particularly Supreme Court decisions, Supreme Court opinions. But this term, our materials are all part of the broad Western tradition and the history of Western civilization. With the exception of the last two, Emerson and the American pragmatists. We start with the Bible. We read some of the plays of Sophocles, some of the dialogues of Plato, the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, Thomas More's Utopia, Locke's Treatise, and Letter on Toleration. These are all non-American, pre-American documents. Thirdly, in the fall, our method was to deal with the generalities, as I've explained, generalities of the Bill of Rights in factual situations, concretized, always concretized. The Supreme Court, in its opinions, sometimes engages in philosophical analysis, in a theoretical discussion, in some historical discussion, but only tangentially, marginally. They are never at the heart of the decision of the court. There's a famous statement of the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, that concepts without percepts are empty. That is, a broad generalization without the specific details is empty. But on the other hand, percepts without concepts are blind. Individual facts, not subsumed under a more general rubric, are blind. They don't speak. They don't say anything. You need both. You need thinking which meshes concepts with percepts, universals with specifics, generalities with facts. The reaction to President Nixon's second inaugural on Saturday has been interesting to me. And the comment that seems to be made more frequently than any other comment is that it all sounded fine as an abstraction. But what he really means remains to be seen when the specifics are spelled out. When he sends the State of the Union message to Congress, he calls upon the Congress for specific enactments. When he sends the budget to the Congress, which will be a map of what he proposes to do, Then when you see the promise of the first, of the second inaugural, you'd be able to test it against the specific that he proposes, then we'll be able to tell what he really means, what he has in mind. This is a typical example of the operation, as it were, of the Kantian maxim of the need to integrate concepts and percepts, the abstraction with the concretion, the general with the specific. This is what we did the first term. Almost every day we were engaged in this process. Now this term too, though it doesn't look like that at the beginning, it may not appear that way to you at this moment, but you will see that the kind of materials we deal with actually in some way involve the same kind of an operation, but where each element at times receives separate concern, separate treatment. Let me give you an example out of the Bible, which is our first reading, and this will start us on the content. The Bible, contrary to the impression a lot of people have who haven't read it, is that it is a theological treatise that if you were to read it, it would be a good deal like a book by Thomas Aquinas or Calvin, a religious book with ideas that are developed. But of course, this is not at all the case. The religious elements, the ethical values, are all, almost all, left to inference. They are seldom made explicit. Let me give you a specific example and then discuss it, and that I think will be more revealing than a lot of my words would be. I want to take a passage which is very famous, the story about Ahab the king and his wife, the queen Jezebel, both infamous characters, and Naboth's vineyard. The story is told in the first book of Kings, chapter 21. Now Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel, beside the palace of Ahab the king of Samaria. Samaria was the northern kingdom after the schism between among the Israel people. The people of Israel, where the northern kingdom came into existence with the capital in Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah with the capital in Jerusalem. And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, the owner of the vineyard, "Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard for it. Or, if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." This was the homestead he had inherited from his father. His father had inherited from his father for many generations. So he wasn't going to part with it. Ahab then went into his house, vexed and sullen, because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And Ahab lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no food. Well, he was that kind of a character. Sulked, is what we would say. But Jezebel, his wife, now she had stamina, she had iron in her veins. His wife, came to Ahab and said to him, "Why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food? And he said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. Jezebel, his wife, said to him, do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread, and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal, and she sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who dwelt with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast and set Naboth on high among the people. That is, expose him, put him up where he could be seen, and set two base fellows opposite him, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, you have cursed God and the king, as charge him with blasphemy and with sedition, cursing God and cursing the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. And the men of his city, the elders and the nobles who dwelt in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them. As it was written in the letters which he had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast, set Naboth on high among the people, and the two base fellows came in and sat opposite him, and the base fellows brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So they took Naboth outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth has been stoned. He is dead. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. And as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, Elijah the prophet, saying, arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who was in Samaria. Behold, he's in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession. And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession? And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick your own blood. Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? One of the great phrases in the Bible. And Elijah answered him, I have found you, because you have sold yourself to what is evil in the sight of the Lord. Behold, I will bring evil upon you. I will utterly sweep you away and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free, in Israel. Dogs shall eat Jezebel within the bounds of Jezreel. Anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And anyone of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the air shall eat. That's one of the great stories in the Bible. But for our purposes, the story says nothing of any abstract character. And this is so typical of the Bible. There's nothing in there about the rule of law, the principle of the rule of law. But of course, the story clearly implies that the king himself is under the law. He cannot make the law. He cannot make murder into something which it isn't. The story doesn't contain a word about the principle of the king being accountable. But of course, the whole point of the story is that the king is accountable for his actions. He's going to be held accountable for his crimes. both he and Jezebel the queen. In any history of the principle of the rule of law, the story of Naboth's vineyard figures prominently, because it's a clear illustration of the principle of the operation of the rule of law, the king being under the law and not outside and not above the law. There isn't a word in the story that says anything about a conception of the due process of law. But of course, the story is told in such a way that you know that the principle of the due process of law operates. Two witnesses were required for the conviction of a serious crime. We know that from other parts of the Bible. Not one witness, but two witnesses. And they had to be eyewitnesses. This was not hearsay. They were there, they saw Naboth, they heard Naboth commit the crimes with which he was charged, like sedition, treason, blasphemy. The story also makes it clear, which we all know, that there's a difference between due process of law as a form and due process of law as substance. You can have the form of due process of law, as you had in the case related in the Bible, and yet, of course, not justice was done, but a great injustice was done. You can comply with all the formalities and yet commit a great outrage. And the story makes that clear. It's not enough to have two witnesses, as the law requires. But they must be honest witnesses. They must tell the truth. We had this problem in the Sacco and Vanzetti case. There were those, for example, at that time, Justice Frankfurter, before he became a justice of the Supreme Court, who wrote a book while the case was still pending about the Sacco and Vanzetti case. And there were others who showed that Sacco and Vanzetti had gotten all the due process in the world. The case was tried in accordance with the law. It was reviewed, different appeals. There was a governor's commission in the state of Massachusetts which reviewed the case. Plenty of due process. But yet there was the strong feeling on the part of a lot of people Sacco and Vanzetti were not guilty. So there's an important distinction that has to be made. And the story, of course, makes that distinction, but by implication, as is true of the Bible generally. The story, of course, clearly implies that private property could not be taken by the king. It could not be taken even for public use without just compensation. The constitutional principle that we have in our constitution is clearly implied in the story. Ahab, the king, still had to negotiate with Naboth. I will give you another vineyard. If you don't want another vineyard, I will give you money, whatever it's worth. Let's negotiate. But that is the fundamental principle of eminent domain. You may not condemn a person's property, you may not take it away from him without just compensation, even for public use, let alone for private use, of course. And the king is not exempt from the operation of that principle. And then you have the very clear manifestation of the, would you please chase the dogs out of here? I don't mind one, but when there are two, I see that students here are distracted. Whoever has one of these dogs, would you please take one of them out at least? You have here, thank you very much, you have here a clear illustration of the operation of prophecy The prophet here, Elijah, was the vehicle of protest. A protest against wrongs, against oppression, against a cruel government, a cruel king, and a cruel queen. The prophet spoke for the higher conscience, not the unconscionable action of the people who were the stooges for Jezebel. Those were officials who were in her service. She wrote a letter to the elders. These were the governors. She told them what to do, and they were tools in her hands. She made them to sin. She made all of Israel to sin by this outrage, because the whole community, in some way or other, felt the stain that fell upon them. Now, they didn't have newspapers in those days. There were no editorials. They didn't resort to street meetings, to demonstrations, to parades. They had their own way. Their way was through the voice of the prophet. Of course, we have that kind of an example constantly in our own day. People who speak out, they don't call themselves prophets, but they are. They think of themselves, and others think of them as in the prophetic tradition. Somebody speaking out for the conscience of the community, the conscience of the society, on behalf of the oppressed, against those who would misuse their power. Now, there's little of this, as I say, that is stated explicitly in the story or in the Bible generally. But it's implied. It is assumed. And we readers have to supply what is left out. Now, when you come to Sophocles, you will find that he deals with problems in the same way. He writes a drama. He doesn't abstractly argue for a principle, but he puts Antigone in a certain position, a certain set of facts, as if, you know, were a case before the Supreme Court. And she states what her position is. You have the same thing with Socrates in prison, as you will read his apology and his statement. It's a living situation. Facts are given, and the values come out of the facts, as it were, in reaction to them. They are organized, the facts are organized in such a way that the values show themselves. So, to come back to what I started to do, to show you the differences and the similarities between the two semesters' work, on the whole, the books that we are going to read this semester, there are a few exceptions, are books which are concerned, and preeminently the Bible, concerned with values, but in factual situations. I will have a lot more to say about this in respect of the Bible particularly. Now, there are some significant differences, and let me briefly state a number of them. In a Supreme Court case, the generality is usually kept separate from the specifics. They're brought together, but they're also kept separate, as the court will state what the principle is, or it will state what the religion clause is that is involved in the case. What is the value? That it is freedom of speech or freedom of assembly. So it will explicate the generality, but at the same time it will deal with the facts in relation to the generality. Religious liberty, but here's a Mormon who claims that religious liberty protects him when he has multiple wives. So you have the two brought together. This is not true of the Bible. That is, the Bible does not generally, as I showed you in the case of the story of Naboth's vineyard, but this is typical, separate one from the other. But a lot is left for the reader to supply by himself. Secondly, in the Supreme Court, this, it seems to me, is very important. It's going to be hard for you at the beginning because of this, what I'm going to talk about. But unless you get used to it, it's going to be less meaningful for you than would otherwise be the case. Now, what I want to say is this. The Supreme Court always argues. It sets up principles, sets up fact, it measures one against the other, it tries to show you, it tries to convince by logical argument that the decision it reaches is the best one, or perhaps the only one, that could be reached. This is not true of the Bible, not generally. There are few places where, you might say, some feeble attempts are made to argue for a proposition. But what the Bible does comes from a totally different style of thought, a different way of thought. We're dealing here with different ways of thinking. We're so used to the ways of thinking that the West by now has, arguing from logical premises, the use of the scientific method, whether in the sciences or in the social sciences, or even now in the humanities, everything has to be quantified, and arguments from statistics and so on. But you don't have that in the Bible, because biblical man thought differently. He thought intuitively. He didn't think logically. There are different ways of thinking. We often forget that. But one is as legitimate as the other. One is as necessary as the other. But you have to be aware of this fact in order to adjust yourself to the style of the Bible. And the style also of Plato. Plato was in two different worlds. But part of his world was in the biblical world. He thought a good deal like biblical man. And this is why later on, in the Hellenistic period, both the Jews and the Christians adopted Plato. And Platonism played a tremendous role in the development of Jewish thought and in the development of Christian thought. But I don't want to anticipate. But in the style of biblical man's thinking, there is very little of an undertaking to argue a point. And of course, much of our lives is lived on the basis of intuition. Oh, you don't decide on whom to love on the basis of logic. Of course, it's done on the basis of intuition. You don't decide on what profession to choose for yourself, what vocation to have, except intuitively. Well, I think you are probably a little restless for the first time meeting with us here. I'll not keep you from your next assignment, but I will continue this when we come back on Wednesday.